Now, this is a very interesting book to me. Well organized and has one of the most beautiful and profound lessons of any of the books of the Old Testament. The prophet came first of all, and then one difference is he brings his problem to God and not to the people. He began by bringing before God the condition of the Jews at that time and asking him why. Why did he allow that condition to exist and not do something about it? God's answer was, I am doing something about it. I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation. March through the breadth of the land, taking lands that are not theirs. Well, this was even more perplexing to the prophet. How could God use a man as wicked as the Chaldeans to punish his own people? So he asked away that question. God's answer was, you wait and see. Wait and see what I'm going to do. It's going to come to pass. So he said, I'm going to get on the watchtower and see what will happen. And so God's answer was that this individual, his soul is puffed up, but my righteous one shall live by faith. And that's why we stopped last time. And that's not a new principle. Abraham lived by faith. His righteousness was imputed unto him. His faith was imputed unto him for righteousness. In fact, faith has always been the basis on which individuals are acceptable with God from the very beginning. But Habakkuk presents it in a way that became really the watchword of the gospel. Paul used this quotation twice, once in Romans, once in Galatians. The writer of Hebrews used it in the 10th chapter. So the righteous shall live by faith is the principle of the gospel. Now, in the second chapter, beginning with verse 5, he turns now to the Chaldeans, or doesn't name it. But he laid down the principle by which God will deal with rulers such as he was. So we have five woes in chapter 2. I want you to look at these carefully. Now, see, the prophet is perplexed. What's going to happen? God's told him. Then God tells him what he's going to do with this a ruler such as this. Woe under that kind of a ruler. Then in the third chapter, the first part of it, the prophet looks back over the past. And as he looks back over the past, he sees in this poetic way of expressing it, he sees God coming to his people in time of need, whenever they're, and coming for their salvation. All right, now that helps him. He now is ready to look to the future, looking to the past for encouragement from God's past actions. He now looks to the future. And that wonderful psalm, the last part of it, I think is one of the greatest on faith anywhere that you'll find. Will God take away everything from him? It matters not what it is, all these avenues of life. Yet, he said, I will trust in Jehovah. I will joy in the God of my salvation. And here's a lesson for us. We don't know what's ahead of us. I know God eventually is going to call this nation to judgment. I know that. How he will do it, I don't know. That's up to him. But I can get comfort from this thought that in times of trials and tribulations, God has always come to his people, always come to their help and rescue. I can believe that. Then I can look to the future and say, will he take away everything from me? I will trust in Jehovah. I'll walk in his way. And that's the lesson I want us to get. And I hope you get it and abide by it and it'll become a part of your life. Turning now to the fourth chapter, I'm going to read that again. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright in him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Yea, moreover, wine is treacherous. A haughty man that keepeth not at home, who enlargeth his desire as Sheol, and he is as death and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all peoples. Shall not all these take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, saying, and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. That's our first woe. Now, I want to look at this wine that he talks about. Now, the alternate reading is, and his wine is treacherous. I think that he's not talking about wine that comes in a bottle. He's talking about the wine of power and conquest on which this ruler is drunk. He's intoxicated on power. He's intoxicated on the idea of world conquest. And that wine is always treacherous. Now, Hitler decided he was Wilhelm first, back when I was a boy. Kaiser Wilhelm was going to conquer the world. Well, his wine was treacherous. He fell. Hitler was going to conquer the world. His wine was treacherous. Didn't succeed. Hussein was going to begin here and get the Arabs all into power, and I think his idea was world conquest also. But it has failed thus far. So as you look back over history, every individual that has been intoxicated or drunk on power, drunk on the idea of world conquest, has always been a treacherous wine. That's a treacherous idea, for they all fall. Every one of them eventually falls. So this is the point of this one. So when he says here, more of the wine, or his wine, is treacherous, and I think that's correct, because his wine is treacherous, a haughty man here, a haughty man that keepeth not at home, who enlargeth his desire as Sheol, and he is as death, and cannot be satisfied. Right? Now notice, first of all, he's not a keeper at home. This has been one of my criticisms of our nation since World War II. Our nation has tried to police the world. And as a result of what we've done in foreign countries, not keeping our own backyard clean, while we're in the mess we're in now. See, we didn't keep it home. What's the responsibility of rulers of a nation? Is to rule that particular country, to look after it, and not try to rule all the world. I know that the motives sounded good and all that. That still is not the function of a government. The function of a government is its own nation or country there, and its purpose is twofold. It's to punish the wicked, the lawbreakers, and second, is to protect the innocent, the righteous. That's its function. I don't know of anything beyond that. And so, but we haven't done that. We try to police the world. Now notice, in his desire, he enlarged his desire as Sheol. Sheol is the unseen that receives every spirit that leaves the body. And Sheol, the unseen there. I know some of them are going to the presence of God, others into a place of torment. But Sheol can't be satisfied. It receives every person. And death, same way. And he is as death. Cannot be satisfied. Is death ever satisfied? Well, it's going to claim every one of us. Of all the billions that live today, death's going to claim every one of them if the world lasts that long. If not, why, it'd be a chain of death anyway. Right? But gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all peoples. Right? Now, that kind of an end, that fellow that's intoxicated on wine, the wine of conquest and power, he then is never satisfied. When he gains one, he wants another. When he gains the next one, he wants one beyond that. Never satisfied. Well, men are that way in business. An individual makes $1 million, he wants another million. He's not satisfied, and that's why he wants to become a billionaire. 1 billion, he wants some more billions. Never satisfied. Just like death and Sheol, his desire is never satisfied. I believe that's correct. All right? Now, shall not all these take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his? How long? And that ladeth himself with pledges. Right, now there's your first woe. Woe unto him that gathereth unto himself that which is not his. And sets out on a mission of world conquest. Those that are not his, he wants to become his. Well, that same thing is true. An individual becomes intoxicated on desire for wealth. He's never satisfied either. When he sets out to make $1 million, he wants $1 billion. If he gets $1 billion, he wants another billion, and so on that. Well, I guess that, I think Ecclesiastes is clear on that. That's the disposition God put in man, is to always look beyond that which he has. Now, the thing is, that attitude ought to be to learn about God and to learn those principles that are for good, rather than just to make money or to conquer, don't you see? It's to learn and all that. I think God intends for an individual to learn all that he can in a lifetime and to use it in the right way. I don't think we ever will ever be satisfied with that point under which we've come. Always strive to know more. Strive to achieve more and accomplish more, but in the right way. So you see, that inward desire that God put there can go the wrong way or it can go the right way, depending on how I govern and control it. Well, that's what he's talking about here. This fellow, wine intoxicated. Now he says, woe unto him that increaseth that which is not his. How long? That's an interesting thing. I've never found, but I think one point where God answered the how long. Ordinarily, when that question is asked, that remains in the realm of God's own providence. How long? How long is this going to be? I don't know. He didn't tell him. But over in one place, and I might just point, I think I've read that before to you, I'm sure I have, but back here in Isaiah, the 6th chapter, when that question, Isaiah asked that question, how long, God answered it. Then, as far as I can remember or recall or notice, this is the only time God answered the question. Now, here he's telling him here in this, I'm undone because I dwell in this. Well, verse 6. Then threw one of the seraphim unto me, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken from with his tongs from off the altar. And he touched my mouth with it and said, lo, this has touched thy lips. Thine iniquity is taken away and thy sin forgiven. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom will I send and who will go for us? Then I said, here am I, send me. And he said, go and tell this people, hear ye indeed and understand not, and see ye indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and should turn again and be healed. Then said I, Lord, how long? Now let's answer that question. You go preach to them. How long, Lord? And I tell them, hear ye indeed, but, no, wait a minute. And he answered, until cities be waste without inhabitant, and houses without man, and the land become utterly waste, and Jehovah have removed men far away, and the forsaken places be many in the midst of the land. All right, so how long? Just until there's nobody else to preach to. And I've carried the people away, the homes are vacant, the cities are destroyed. You preach until there's nobody to preach to. I've thought of that many, many times. How long shall a preacher keep preaching? I read about these preachers retiring. How long shall a preacher keep on preaching the word? Well, my answer is just as long as there's anybody to preach to. As long as I have the ability and people will listen to me, I keep on teaching. That time will come and you won't want to hear me. Nobody else will. I know that. Well, that time comes, I'm going to quit. I'll stop then. But until that time comes, I keep on trying to teach the best I can. Whoever listened to me. Though there'll be few or many. Well, all right. How long? God didn't answer this question because this pertained to God. How long before this will come back? That's my business. With Isaiah, how long shall I preach? That's Isaiah's responsibility. So long as anybody listen to you. So if it's a question pertaining to God's own providence, God doesn't answer that question. Have you noticed that? I've said this many times. I'm sure you've noticed also. The Bible never asks, God never answers a question that's raised out of mere curiosity. You've noticed that? Those questions that just merely gratify curiosity, God doesn't fool with them. Only those questions that either pertain to his part of the work or my part of the work that pertain unto salvation, God answers those questions. I don't believe you'll find a question that isn't answered. I may not have the answer. I believe it's there. All right? So that's the first woe. Now notice further, shall they not rise up suddenly, these that have been a woe to him that increaseth, shall they not rise up suddenly, thou shalt bite thee and awake and shall vex thee, and thou shalt be for booty unto them, because thou hast plundered many nations, and the remnant of the peoples shall plunder thee, because of men's blood, and for the violence done to the land, to the city, and to all that dwell therein. Now, as you conquered people, and you made booty out of what they had, now, eventually, they're going to rise up, overthrow you, and they will take what you've accumulated here as booty unto themselves. I think Russia has done that. I've said a long time that would happen eventually. That after I learned the lesson of Habakkuk many years ago, I learned that eventually the people of Russia would revolt against that regime. They would overthrow that regime and take what they had plundered from other people, and they would divide it up or use it or destroy it or something else. Well, that's really what has happened. And it'll happen to China one of these days. They're holding people under so long, but after a while, they're going to explode and they'll plunder them. All right? So this is what God says about it. All right, now here's the second woe. That's the first one. That's woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. All right? Now second, verse 12, no 9. Woe to him that getteth an evil gain for his house. Now here are three things. Getteth an evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high, he may be delivered from the hand of evil. All right, now that's the fellow. His nest is his family there. May set his nest, his rule on high. So here's a fellow now that, as he says here, he gets gain for his house. I think that's his household, his family. He wants his family to be put in a position of rule, so he works it that his family and his descendants will keep on in the place of rule there. But that'll come to an end eventually. It may go on for hundreds of years like England has. It'll come to an end after a while. But I noticed that this fellow is one that conquers, and England was that way once. She would conquer the world. She would dominate the world at one time. But now that's been lost unto her. We police the world, my generation. That'll come to an end after a while. We'll go broke. Somebody else then will take over where we left off, don't you see? So these are woes here that are according to the principle of God's rule in the affairs of men. That's what you want to remember to see in this. All right, so here then, evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the hand of evil. So he wants to build up his house, set his nest on high, and keep all his little chicks together under his wing, don't you see, and protect himself from all evil or overthrow. Well, that doesn't work. That eventually comes apart. And now he goes on to say here, thou hast devised shame to thy house by cutting off many peoples, and hast sinned against thy soul. Now I know that God said, I'm going to raise him up. But he said back here in verse 11, and he shall pass over and be guilty, even he whose might is his God. He's guilty of what he has done. Here he has sinned against his soul. So in trying to, in putting other people down, building his house up, he has sinned against his soul. I don't care if he's a heathen or what he is. It's a sin because it's against God's principle of right, against God's moral law. He put everybody under back in when Adam transgressed a sin. For the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. That just simply means that everything that he's done will testify against him, against himself. Well, all right, that's fair, I think. He built it up. Now they're coming back to him. What goes around comes around, or what it says, something like that. But now the third woe. Now that one there is to him that gets evil gain for his house, wants to build up his own family. And all that is cost of others. Third, woe to him that buildeth a town with blood and establisheth a city with iniquity. All right, now here's this fellow that conquers, conquered the tyrant, and he takes these people, makes slave laborers out of them, and here then they work until they drop dead, they haul off the body, don't pay any attention to it. Life means nothing to them. That's always true of the tyrant. You're not concerned with life or the rights of individuals. All he wants is the service out of them. When they're sick or dead, he's through with them. Makes no provision for them in that. That's the tyrant. Our country's never done that. Many of these things our nation has been guilty of. I think it's effort to police the world is wrong. I think we made a mistake there, some of these things. I don't believe any of the rulers have tried to get their own families in there and done these things. I think we've done pretty good in some ways here. All right? But now notice here, behold, is it not of Jehovah, of hosts, that the people labor for the fire and the nations weary themselves for vanity. I thought about this passage back in World War II when England was being bombed, how that there, up until that time, the laborers got very little, and they used child labor, mistreated their little children, child labor, all that sort of thing. And so as they did that, yeah, they were building for what? For the fire. So I remember seeing those pictures of the fires of London as they were burning then. I thought of this passage here. They've been building, but building for what? For the fire. So the men in using labor and oppressing the laborers there to build your own empire, that's always wrong. It's always wrong. And of course the other extreme is when the laborers then take over and they destroy the powers that employed them. That's also wrong. So you see, you've got two wrongs here, and generally we only see one of those wrongs. We're just constituted as such. If I am a member of a union, I can see it only from the union's point of view. If I am a member of the, or got stock in the company and all that, I see it from the company's point of view. But really, isn't there another point of view there? That is, that which is right for both the laborer and for the employer. There's that which is right for both them, and both must exist together if we're going to endure as a people. That's principle still true. I don't know how you feel toward union or toward non-union or anything like that. It doesn't matter. I'm not arguing that. What I'm talking about is here, we've got to see the two sides of the situation, and the two are going to have to work together. The same thing with the President and Congress. They've got to work together. They don't work together anymore. I don't know whether they ever did or not. I just know it's more we know more about it now than we used to. All right? And so it's all in our society. I don't like this idea of Afro-Americans, Chinese-Americans, Japanese-Americans, Muslim-Americans, and English-Americans. Don't like that. We're going to be America. We ought to be Americans and work for the good of our country and our all people. But we're falling into sects. Here's the Jewish American, the black Americans, and so on that. And everyone is for himself, and the devil take the hindmost. And that's not going to work. So we destroy ourselves, and that's the spirit that characterizes us. Well, what's the answer to it? The answer is God's way. God's plan. That's the only answer. The Bible lays down that relation of the employer and the employee very clearly there, the servant and the master, very clearly. Right? And the rich toward the poor toward the rich, that's clearly dealt with. I know that our nation is against Jesus Christ and God and all that they teach, and that's the base on which we're going to fall. I don't think it's very far away. You can't go on like we're going here with this humanistic, atheistic philosophy that rules God out and lets every man live according to his own, what he wants to do it, God had effects. Well, you can't do that and last. You're bound to fall. Well, that's what Habakkuk is teaching. That's what God's trying to teach Habakkuk about. Now let's look a little further. All right? And for the bill for the fire, and the nations weary themselves for vanity. Yeah, they weary themselves for emptiness, for that which is like breath, going to pass away. What's all this we've labored for in this country? What's it for? Eventually the fire. Yeah, the fire eventually get it. It goes up like vapor. It's been vanity for that which is not real. The real is on the side of the spiritual. I've got to learn that. You've got to learn. Now, we've got to teach that. We're not getting across, but that's so. For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Jehovah as the waters cover the sea. That doesn't mean everybody's going to know all about God. That means that God's rule is going to be recognized throughout the world. I mean, it'll extend throughout the world. I don't care what the nation is. These principles that God lays down are principles that express the glory of God. So nations fall, rise, exist, and fall. Right? What's back of that? God's rule in the kingdom of men. So you see, his glory, it covers the earth. And wherever you go, you see the principles that God set forth in operation. Whether people understand them or believe them or accept them or not, they still operate. You follow me? All right? And I need to learn that lesson. You need to learn it. We all need to learn it. So I can understand what's taking place when I watch the news and on the television, if you do watch it. And I don't waste much of my time watching it anymore. But I ought to keep up more. I know that. But I'm just not particularly interested in that. I'm more interested in something else. All right, now here's the fourth. Now some of the fourth would be his woe. Alright, now that one is woe to him that buildeth the town with blood. They're not concerned with it and established it with iniquity. And it has no concern for how it's being done. You just get it done. That's all that way it was in those days. Now woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, to thee that addest thy venom, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. All right, now I think you're back to that same wine we talked about a while ago. Let me read a couple of passages, if I may, here. In Isaiah, the 29th chapter, and also the 51st. And a couple of passages there that I want you to look at there that teach this same thing here that I'm emphasizing. 29th chapter, and verse 9, I believe it is. Tarry ye and wonder. Take your pleasure and be blind. They're drunken, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. For Jehovah poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, and it closed your eyes of the prophets, and your heads of the seers had he covered. And all vision has become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned, saying, read this, I pray you, but he said, I can't read it. You hand it to another man, he said, I can't read it either. Why, now they're drunk, but not with wine. What are they drunk with? They're drunk on pleasure. They're drunk on idolatry. They're drunk on conquest. They're drunk on all these things that intoxicate a man and make him give him an unbalancing. He's unbalanced there. Right now, over now in the 51st chapter. In the 51st chapter, you have another one there, 51 and verse 21. That one. Therefore, hear now this, thou afflicted and drunken, but not with wine. Thus saith thy Lord Jehovah, and thy God pleadeth the cause of the people, behold, I have taken out of thy hand the cup of staggering, even the bowl of the cup of my wrath. Thou shalt no more drink of it again, and I will put it into the hand of them that afflict thee. Now what was that bowl on which they were drunk? They were drunk and staggering under the judgment that God had sent upon them. Now then, I'm going to take that away from you. Now I'm going to hand that bowl to the Chaldeans that subjected you then, and they're going to get drunk on the same thing. They're drunk on a judgment, stagger around under the judgment there. So you see, the point I'm making here is true. Now, so what does this one mean back here in the verse 15 then? Woe to him that giveth his neighbor drink, to thee that addest thy venom. All right, now here the fellow that conquers. Now he gives this fellow unto him. He gives him power over other individuals. And so here, well, we might start like this. Here there is a power up here. Now they come on down. Well, he gives power to this one. He gives power to individuals under him here. All of these are given power here. Here's another, gives him power. He gives certain ones power. And come on like that. So here the idea is, this fellow here, he got the power back here. And he gives power to this individual, this one here, this one, and they give power to these here. They're all drunk on the same drink there. He gives and he adds his venom. That is that poison that had been in his drink, that's in the other fellow's drink. So you see, this idea of power here, and drunk on power or conquest or wealth or whatever it is, we're handed on down to others, and they become drunk on the same thing. So woe here is, woe to him that giveth his neighbor drink, to thee that addeth thy venom and maketh him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. That is, strip them, you see. Everyone has to strip the fellows that are under him in order for him to get rich himself there. That's the point there. Thou art filled with shame and not glory. Drink thou also, and be as one uncircumcised. The cup of Jehovah's right hand shall come round unto thee. Now that's the cup of judgment. And foul shame shall be upon thy glory. For the violence done to Lebanon shall cover thee, and the destruction of the beast which made them afraid, because of man's blood and for the violence done to the land, to the city, to all that dwell therein. All right, now that's destroying those great cedars of Lebanon there, or taking the things that God has got, natural resources, and misusing them, destroying them. Well, the way that we've used our resources, we've destroyed so much of it, it's going to come back on us. And so here these fellows with power, all they want is power to take from the other fellow down here and come on up to the top there. Well, woe unto that kind of a system. Woe unto that kind of a government. Woe unto that kind of individual there. This is the point. The woe is from God, under the wrath of God here. But all right, that's the fourth one. And to destroy. Class is always wrong to destroy that which God has given us. How that over there in Kuwait there, when Hussein sat on 120 some odd, or however many it was, might have been more than that, I remember now the number. All of oil wells, well, that's destroying resources God has given. That's wrong. And we say, well, all things clad in war and love. No, it's not so. So here comes war, and we set about to destroy the resources that God intended to use for the good of mankind. I know why it's done, all right, sure. But we want to get to them before we get to us. And all that goes back to the wrong concept from the very beginning of our thinking, don't you see? All right, these are things I hope you'll think of. Now let me get to the fifth one. What profiteth the graven image? Now this one, he begins not with a woe, but with a thing that leads to it. What profiteth the graven image that the maker thereof hath engraven it, the molten image, even the teacher of lies, he that fashioneth it its form, trusteth therein to make dumb idols. All right, now what prophet is a dumb idol? Right, now notice here he said it's a teacher of lies. That's right, idolatry is a lie, it's a falsehood that deceived people down through the years there. When they engraven the molten image, the teacher of lies had put it together there, and it's a lie. The teacher of the lie formed it and made it there. Therein and make dumb idols. Woe unto him that saith to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise. Shall this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in the midst of it. But Jehovah is in his holy temple, and all the earth keeps silence before him. Here then is the woe upon an individual who turns to an idol, who looks to an idol, who trusts in an idol. Here's a woe upon that individual who teaches idolatry, who formed it, made it. So here's the teacher of lies, and here the lie itself. God's woe is pronounced upon that. Well, that would take that any false religion, any false system would come under this heading here, and woe unto that. It doesn't. You can't take a dumb idol and make it talk. You can't say it can't teach you what's right, can't teach you what's wrong, can't do anything at all for you. I think the greatest, to me, the most sarcastic, almost, if not sarcastic or ironical, statement concerning an idol is in the 44th chapter of the book of Isaiah. We're going to look at it in just a moment. We're going to read that, although you may be familiar with it. This is against idolatry. Notice what it says here, beginning with verse 9. They that fashion a graven image are all of them vanity. That is, emptiness there. Confusion. All of them are vanity. And the things that they delight in shall not profit. And their own witnesses see not, nor know, that they may be put to shame. Who hath fashioned a god or a molten image that is profitable for nothing? Behold, it is just profitable for nothing. Who fashioned? Behold, all his fellows shall be put to shame, and the workmen, they are of men. Let them all be gathered together. Let them stand up. They shall fear. They shall be put to shame together. Why? Because the idol can't save them. The idol that they make into a thing for them. I know further. The smith maketh an axe, and worketh in the coals, and fashioneth it with hammers, and worketh it with his strong arm. Yea, he is hungry, and his strength faileth. He drinketh no water, and is faint. Now, here is a man that formed the axe, and has cut down the tree, and the hammer, that hammered out the gold or silver to cover it, and he gets hungry, he's healthy, he gets thirsty, and he faints, and he's weak himself, don't you see? So here the whole idol began in weakness there, on the part of man. What can it do for you? The carpenter stretcheth out a line, he marketh it out with a pencil, he shapeth it with planes, and he marketh it out with the compasses, and shapeth it after the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, to dwell in a house. Now here the man cuts down the wood, God provided the wood, God provided the metal that went into the axe there, and that went into the plane. And he cuts that tree down, he marks it out with a compass, that originally said he and him, and so he fashioned this. But where are you going to put it? We'll put it in a house. It can't be with him everywhere. It's got to be in the house. Now, think about that. God can be with you everywhere. But this idol you make, it's got to be wherever you set the thing up. You set it up in yonder, that's where it's going to stay. You get ready to move it and dust the corner out there where it was, put it in another corner, dust it off after a while. All right, so he said, and he was down all that. Now, know what he does with it. All right, after a man to dwell in a house, he heweth him down cedars and taketh a holm tree and the oak and strengtheneth for himself one among the trees of the forest. He planteth a fir tree and the rain doth nourish it. Where'd the rain come from? That came from God. Who made it to grow? God made it to grow. What did man do? He set it out, but he didn't give it life. He didn't give it life. Life in that tree, if it wasn't in that thing put out there, it would have died. I mean, if it were dead, it would have just rotted there, and they would have lived. So that, something come. He didn't provide anything. He said, just put it out there. God gave it the rain. Then shall it be for a man to burn, and he taketh thereof and warmeth himself. Yea, he kindleth it and baketh bread. Yea, he maketh a god and worshipeth it. He maketh it a graven image and falleth down there too. Now notice, he burned part of it. Now the tree couldn't help itself. The tree is planted, God provided the rain and it grew. Now then, when he does that, while the man cuts it down, the tree couldn't help itself, couldn't hinder it. And then he fashioned it and made he baked bread with part of it and warmed himself with part of it, that the fire made him a god out of the rest of it. How silly can a fellow be? You think about that. Now notice, he burneth part thereof in the fire, and part thereof he eateth flesh, with part thereof he eateth flesh. He roasteth roast and is satisfied. He warmeth himself and says, aha, I am warm. I have seen the fire. Right? But that tree out of which he made a god couldn't do a thing in the world in its own protection. And man burned it, baked some bread for him, roasted some meat of that, and warmed himself. The fire of this from which he made an idol, made a god. And the residue thereof, he maketh a god. Even his graven image, he falleth down unto it and worshipeth, and prayeth unto it, and saith, deliver me, for thou art my God. But what could that wood do before he made a god out of it? Couldn't deliver itself from anything. It burned part of it for this, burned part of it for something else, huh? Made a god out of it, and I said, deliver me. What could he do from nothing? That's the silliest thing in the world, idolatry. They know not, neither do they consider, for he has shut their eyes that they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. And none calleth to mind, neither is there knowledge or understanding to say, I have burned part of it. Yet they don't even realize it. They've got their eyes are closed. I have burned part of it. Say, I have burned part of it in the fire. They also have baked bread upon the coals thereof. I have roasted flesh and eaten it. And shall I make the residue out an abomination? Shall I fall down to the stock of a tree? He feedeth on ashes, that fellow does. A deceived heart hath turned him aside, and he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? That's a great passage. That's Isaiah, the 44th chapter, if you want to remember it, verses 9 through 21. I think that's one of the most sarcastic criticism of idolatry I know. But let me go on now and finish up. So woe to this man that saith to the wood, awake, and to the dumb idol arise. Shall this teach? So overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath at all in the midst of it. But Jehovah is in his holy temples, where all the earth keeps silence before him. Now, I've been in church buildings where they had that back there, and Jehovah's in the holy temple keeps silence. Apply it to that of the congregation, come in and be silent there. That's not what he's talking about. Where is his holy temple? Psalm 11:4. Thy throne, O God, is in the heavens. The heavens are the temple of God. That's the throne. That's where he is. He's in heaven. Now let me recognize that and bow in silent reverence before a God such as he is. And an idol can't save us. Man made it. All that. Well, that's true of anything else that man made. Our guns and our military can't save us. When the time comes that God said we put our faith in that, you hear in his campaign speeches here about how great America is and how strong it is and all that, nothing can conquer us. Leave God out of our thinking. We can't do that. That's what we've done. That's why we're in the mess we're in today. We've left God out of, he's been ruled out of the thinking of the average American today. I'll talk about that, I guess, after a while tonight, one or the other, I forget which was the point. we'll make on that, how that we will rule God out. We'll leave him out of our thinking. When we do that, we're on our own, and when we're in the midst of trouble, in the middle of trouble. Now, there's our trouble today. Now, you can listen to the politician, and they can say all they want to about this reason and that reason and some other reason. There's just one reason why we're in this mess. We've left God out of our thinking. That's all. We've left his principles of right out. We're now looking to humanism and atheism and evolution and these things here to answer these problems. Reading about a scientist the other day, this last week, and there were people there, Paulus, I believe they're calling him, whatever his name is. He's been a great scientist, made some great contributions. He's an atheist. I just don't see how a man can be an atheist and a scientist at the same time. He got no answer for these things. You put them together, where they come from, why they act like they do. He can't answer that. Atheism is as silly as any thing in the world. Communism, all those isms that leave God out, are the root of the ruin of that particular nation and people. We've got to realize that, and I don't know what we're going to do about it. We've got to get the message across some way, but we're not getting it across. Now, back to the idea of the prophets that we've been studying. I couldn't make it up. I ask you to try to look at three things. The three things in the prophets. First of all, what was the condition of the people? And how was the prophet to meet that? All right, we see the condition of preaching God to the people. All right? Look at the condition of our nation today or individual lives. What's wrong with either one? How is that going to be remedied? By preaching God to the people. Not by making new laws, not by legislating more money for education. Preach God to them. Second, look also at God in the nations. He rules in the midst of the nation and his people that came like the heathen. He destroyed them like he did the heathen. Alright? So since there's nothing permanent there, where is the permanence? The permanence is found in the kingdom of God and the Messiah, the ruler that was to come. So in reading the prophets, what was the condition? How was it met? It was met by preaching God. What was God's attitude to the nations? He raised up one, you to destroy another one, then destroys it because of its wickedness. Right? What's permanent? The kingdom that was to come in Jesus Christ that the Old Testament prophets were filled with as they looked at the coming of the kingdom that should never be shaken. The kingdom would not be shaken. And the ruler that would never be dethroned. That's what we look for in that. Turn to the New Testament. Now we see that kingdom established. We see that ruler on the throne. We see carrying out principle of God, and those that submit to him are blessed, those that don't submit to him are not blessed. They come to the point like we are today. So you can't get atheism, can argue as long as you want to. When you get through without God, you're always unhappy.